So hopefully that's what will happen. I don't know anything about this opera the man was talking about, but if his message is in there, then that's a good thing.
Exactly.
I appreciate you, and I appreciate you talking about him today.
Thank you so much, Anita. Thank you so much. You've been listening to More Talk Radio here in your community radio station. I'm Cecil Prescott. Been talking about Malcolm, who said, time is on the side of the oppressed today. It's against the oppressor. Truth is on the side of the oppressed today. You don't need anything else. Let us remember the legacy of people such as Malcolm and the hundreds of thousands of people we do not know of. I'm Cecil Prescott. Thank you for listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. Stay tuned for more programming.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during the last week of our spring membership drive, your support can go even further. Contribute today at bit.ly/KBOO, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now and help us reach our $60,000 goal by May 25th. Thanks so much.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. And on today's show, we look at how the lying billionaires are killing us and how we fight back. Last week, the Washington Post reported that a handful of pro-Israel billionaires pressured the New York mayor to crack down on student protests against genocide. Last month, Open Secrets released their report on the millions given to American politicians by pro-Israel lobbying groups like American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and Christians United for Israel, CUFI, as well as by military contractors and oil and gas lobby groups. Earlier this month, we learned that Trump told oil and gas executives that if they gave him $1 billion, he would roll back environmental regulation and expand permits for oil drilling. And we've known for years that Exxon knew as early as 1977 just how badly their product was destabilizing the climate. Today on The Old Mole, we'll hear Jan Hocken talking with scholar Jennifer Ruth about the Palestine exception to free speech and academic freedom. We'll hear from Joe Clement about limits to growth and how climate activists have responded. And we'll hear from the Left and the Law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, with an update on legal strategies pursued by nonprofits like Our Children's Trust and governments like Multnomah County in the effort to address the harms caused by climate change. That is, we'll hear about alternatives to mainstream denials of genocide, alternatives to mainstream mystifications of education, alternatives to accepting the extractive economy that's damaging us all. The Old Mole Variety Hour has been bringing you alternatives to the mainstream capitalist view of the world for over 30 years, and KABU has been bringing you alternatives to mainstream media for over 50 years. Thank you to all of those helping KABU continue providing alternatives. Thank you to those who have already contributed to our spring membership drive focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. And thank you to the donor who has given us a $20,000 matching pledge, so every donation you make will be doubled dollar for dollar. This is the last week of our drive to raise $60,000 by May 25th, so if you've been waiting, now is the time to join us. You can help by going to bit.ly/KBOO or texting KABU to 44321 or clicking on the red donate box in the mobile app or mailing a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. On May 1st, the U.S. House passed a bill adopting a highly contested definition of anti-Semitism that defines criticism of Israel or of Zionism as inherently anti-Semitic. Legislation that has implications for what can be taught and what forms of speech or scholarship fall under the rules of the Civil Rights Act. In our first segment today, Jan Hocken talks with Jennifer Ruth, a professor at Portland State University who's published extensively on academic freedom and free speech issues. They talk about the history of what some scholars term the Palestine exception to free speech or academic freedom, and how students and faculty are organizing in response. Then we'll hear from Joe Clement, reading from the book Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy by Allison Hope Alcon. The chapter he selects from explores the shifts from 1970s climate discourse that recognized a need to end or at least challenge capitalism to later approaches that accepted capitalism as inevitable and succumbed to the idea that it could be made sustainable. Finally today, Jan Hocken returns with Mike Snedeker for a Left in the Law update on legal cases against big oil. Cases that increasingly turn on evidence that oil corporations knew decades ago that their businesses were not compatible with sustaining a stable climate. As always, we will be posting the audio of the show and its segments, along with links to more information on our website at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. The KABU website is due for an update, so it may be down at times, but you can help us afford the update and keep KABU on air and online by going to bit.ly/KBOO to join and donate. Now here's Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth discussing recent attacks on academic freedom.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Jennifer Ruth, professor of film studies at Portland State University, and a scholar who has published extensively on academic freedom and free speech issues. She is co-author with Michael Berube of two books, The Humanities, Higher Education, and Academic Freedom, Three Necessary Arguments, and It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom. And she's co-editor with Valerie Johnson and Ellen Schrecker of The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing War on Academic Freedom, recently released. Well, Jennifer Ruth, welcome to KABU and again to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me again, Jan.
Well, at a teach-in at Portland State University on April 29th, you talked about the crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests around the country, and you referred to what you term the Palestine exception. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in mentioning the books that I've co-authored, I work on academic freedom issues, and it's a pretty well-known phrase, the Palestine exception to academic freedom and free speech in academic freedom circles. It's widely used, even by people who are not particularly invested in human rights or justice for Palestinians. And the common use of the phrase speaks to the wide acknowledgement that speech and scholarship around Israel-Palestine is handled differently in the U.S. than other speech and scholarship, and that Palestine and advocacy for Palestine has long served as the limit case for acceptable political advocacy. The phrase draws our attention to the fact that while the law might theoretically protect the right to advocate for Palestinian freedom, powerful social forces will not only punish those who do, they will also punish those who don't act quickly enough to crush pro-Palestinian advocates. And we've seen this since October. Suspensions and expulsions of students who spoke out, the revocation of job offers that were made once students speak out on behalf of Palestine, the doxing campaigns in New York, calling people who have advocated for stopping the genocide, calling them anti-Semites. We've seen the Palestine exception in practice over the last half year. And we've also seen the punishing of those who do not themselves crush pro-Palestinian advocates. So what I mean by that is that if someone in a position of power doesn't move to silence and suppress or discipline Palestinian advocates, they themselves might find themselves on the hot seat. So this began most spectacularly, of course, with the December 5th congressional hearings on anti-Semitism.
And you were on the Old Mole in December, actually, to talk about the congressional hearings that month, where presidents of MIT, Harvard, and UPenn, all women presidents, some new to that position, were interrogated in what you describe as a McCarthyist demand for presidents crack down on what they claim to be rampant anti-Semitism on their campuses. So what about this most recent appearance of Columbia's President Manoush Shafiq before the committee last month? She had the benefit of seeing what happened to her colleagues a few months prior and how they responded, many concluded quite badly under fire. How would you describe the scene on April 17th with Columbia's president's testimony?
I was here to talk about the December 5th congressional hearings. And of course, we recall that they were punished, widely humiliated in the mainstream press for their lawyerly-like answers. They said what was actually true, which is that investigations for hate speech, you know, you have to show due process and the context matters. So, for example, you can't presume, as Elise Stefanik clearly tried to sort of channel them into saying that From the River to the Sea is a call for genocide. It isn't. It actually depends on context.
Context became a dirty word in those hearings.
Exactly.
A way of evading taking a firm stance, even though, of course, all of higher education is about understanding context.
Exactly, which shows you how the anti-intellectual fascist movements, right-wing movements in the past have often had an anti-intellectual, anti-higher education component. You know, William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale, the superstitions of academic freedom. So the anti-intellectual aspect of it, the anti-contextualizing aspect of it shouldn't surprise us. And yet,
particularly in this country, we might say.
Right. And yet so much of the mainstream press just jumped on that as if they were idiots for raising the question of context. And so April 17th, Columbia University President Shafiq, she proved that she had learned the lesson from the December 5th hearings. And the lesson that she'd learned was to appease, placate, crack down, say that she will discipline students and faculty for speech that really would be dependent on context for how it should be interpreted. She threw students under the bus. She threw specific faculty members under the bus and named them in a congressional hearing, which is probably, I mean, I spent 3 years going with faculty who are under investigation at Portland State for various things. And she has to have broken some kind of laws or rules around privacy in doing that and naming people in a congressional hearing. But she proved that she was not going to make the mistakes they did. She was going to be a toady in Congress and turn around and be a dictator on campus. Now, by learning that lesson, she also found herself learning a new lesson, which is that students refuse to be bullied into being complicit in genocide. So students were not going to let her throw them under the bus. They protested. And when she sent the police in to arrest protesters, more students joined. And it sparked a national movement on campuses across the country to speak up on behalf of the genocide of Gazans and also against the U.S. government's complicity in that genocide.
Parenthetically, I watched a program today on Democracy Now! Where the president of Union Theological Seminary, which is affiliated, in a sense, part of Columbia, saying the complete opposite position. Their board voted to divest from businesses that deal directly with Israel. They opened their campus to commencements that the Columbia Law students that could not have their commencement or participate on that campus. And it's become, interestingly, a kind of sanctuary within the larger Columbia system for protesters. And so there certainly have, on the positive side, been enormous advances in allies and faculty and student groups speaking up. So, Jennifer, how is this moment different from previous periods when criticism of Israel was suppressed or has been very costly for Palestinian scholars or critics of Israel, critics of Zionism that have been targeted as anti-Semitic, some of whom have lost their jobs or tenure because of that line of scholarship?
That's right. So there's been these sort of eruptions of cases over the years. The boycott, divest, sanction campaign starting in 2005 was one of those moments where there was a crackdown and various states even passed laws that you can't do business in their state if you have signed on to boycott, divest, and sanction campaigns. So it's been ongoing for quite a while. And so there's been some particularly infamous cases, like first Norman Finkelstein at DePaul, who Alan Dershowitz went after. And so Finkelstein, for his work historicizing the crimes against humanity or the atrocities during the Nakba of Israelis, that kind of stuff, he was denied tenure. More recently, Stephen Salida was first given a job offer, and then the job offer was taken away because of tweets he'd made critical of Israel. So it's been an ongoing thing. And there's, of course, a very powerful lobbying group, AIPAC, that's involved in pressuring campaigns and creating organized campaigns against people that they see as critical of Israel. But the difference today, the thing that makes this moment different, I think, is the fact that we have a generation that is responding to it so robustly and seems to be savvy to the ways in which pressure gets exerted, to the ways in which the Palestine exception gets exercised. They seem to be savvy to that. They understand that that's what's happening. And it's a generation who is watching in real time on TikTok and other places and Instagram, watching people get bombed, children get pulled out of the rubble, children traumatized. You know, that we have, I think it's like 13,000 children dead, 17,000 orphaned, and who knows how many maimed. The generation today can see this. And the irony is that this is a generation that apparently, and I say this with having done some kind of informal surveying of my students, has internalized the lesson of never again and is saying, not in my name, never again. I'm seeing a genocide. And what one does when one sees a genocide is tries to protest and stop it and do whatever they can within their power. So whether it be to put pressure on Biden to change his policies through, for example, the Michigan...
Uncommitted.
That's right. Or whether it's to pressure your own university to be transparent about its funds and make sure that it's not invested in any, either in anything related to Israel or anything that helps sort of, you know, deliver weapons to Israel, like Boeing. So these students are pretty incredible. What's interesting too to me is that the campaign of Elise Stefanik, Virginia Fox, the ones who are trying to pass things like the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act to try to enforce an overly expansive definition of anti-Semitism, the right-wing campaigns to do that, they've been in high gear trying to demonize this particular generation for at least more like 10 years. It's always referred to as the young generation. Of course, that generation now has changed. But originally, the right-wing campaign around critical race theory, around so-called divisive concepts, mocked this generation for being snowflakes was first said. Then this generation was characterized as an illiberal mob who was cancel culturing everybody. And now, of course, they're pro-Hamas terrorists. There's a lot of work, overdrive going on in trying to demonize the last 10 years of young people, essentially.
There are also lessons in some of the focus on feelings or discomfort in the classroom as a register of oppression. So those who are on this bandwagon about rampant anti-Semitism confusing Jewish students who have a strong identification with Israel, with Zionism, of feeling uncomfortable or unsafe is different from them feeling objectively unsafe. And so we're having to revisit that issue of how you feel unsafe versus objectively being threatened, but through now this assault on probably the most important anti-war movement in decades. So there are lessons around the way in which emotional reactions, what used to be called microaggressions or trigger warnings in the classroom. And those were big debates we had years ago about what students should be able to experience at the level of discomfort in the classroom. And now that argument is being weaponized by pro-Israel Zionists who point to the discomfort of students, of Jewish students. And of course, then Jewish students who are part of this movement say, yeah, we're always uncomfortable when we're confronted with things that are disturbing. And it's very disturbing that we see before our eyes a genocide unfolding. So the fact that you're feeling uncomfortable has to do with a struggle you're having and we're all having now.
Yeah, it's all part of the same movement, right-wing movement. So originally calling the students snowflakes because they were actually more sensitive to social injustice than, you know, the so-called adults, to calling them snowflakes, that was the beginning of it. And then it twists to adapt to whatever the movement needs. So it's not worried about consistency. So then during the snowflake moment, the trigger warning moment, there was all of this push to embrace an absolutist notion of free speech. And there was a lot of pressure. There were, you know, bills trying to be passed to protect free speech as if it was under attack. Of course, now the bill is to try to punish speech, punish from the river to the sea, those kinds of things. Consistency doesn't matter in movements like this. It just adapts to, in a kind of dialectical way, what's going on. So we've been, you know, well into a long-term campaign to demonize social and racial justice issues. Before the McCarthyite congressional hearings, we had the Trump executive order on DEI and divisive concepts in 2020. That then, even though it was rescinded by Biden, it just metastasized at the state level. And we had all of the red states and their education gag orders. And we had the kind of gaslighting that of the right wing saying that anti-racism is the new racism against white people. And so the discomfort around divisive concepts was concern around the so-called discomfort of white people. Now we're seeing the gaslighting around the from the river to the sea being we're being told it's a call for genocide, or that criticism of Zionism is inherently anti-Semitic. All of this kind of gaslighting is continuous with what's been going on around race, but now it's going on around anti-Semitism and in response to the Israel-Palestine conflict in order to kind of shave off yet another contingent of people who might join with the right wing. Because now this so-called progressive Jewish liberals, some of them might be vulnerable to this kind of propaganda around the students being anti-Semitic and the students calling for genocide. And if you're vulnerable to that, then you might find yourself hand in hand with some of the Christian Zionists and white right-wing Christian nationalists and people like Chris Rufo, who's incredibly proud of the fact that he and Bill Ackman are now good buddies after 10/7 and after Rufo's trying to demonize this generation as pro-Hamas terrorists.
In the recent congressional hearings with chancellors or superintendents of public schools who actually did much better in managing all of this, they're used to being interrogated by communities and legislators. And one congressperson spoke up and said, you know, I don't hear my colleagues condemning Donald Trump for having a known anti-Semite for dinner. His at Charlottesville saying, well, there are good people on both sides in defending white nationalists who were, using overt neo-Nazi symbols and phrases, and the right wing has trafficked heavily in anti-Semitism for a long time in an organized and conscious way. So there's, I think, the blatant hypocrisy of the moment is also quite evident to students who often have more time to think about things and follow things than older people who get glimpses of this through the media.
Another angle on the hypocrisy is that there's a lot of right-wing money right now circulating, posing itself as a solution to the problem of the incivil speech of our students and our students being unable to deliberate in a civil way and have meaningful dialogue with one another. So you pose the problem that they can't do it, and you sort of reference the polarized country, which may or may not, they're less polarized than, you know, people over 30. But you reference the polarized country, you reference their supposed inability to deliberate civilly, and you put money into schools to model civil discourse. When, of course, it's not the students who are saying things like grab them by the like the complete hypocrisy around crass and crude and bullying language of some of the major figures on the right. They're the ones who need the lesson in civil discourse.
As well as much that's in full display. So there's a lot of revisiting of history, the history of the anti-war movement, revisiting questions around tactics in a movement and how to draw on previous eras of struggle, including the anti-apartheid movement around South Africa. And I think there's a lot of interest in the history of Israel and Palestine and the false narrative of Palestinians being offered so many times a two-state solution, turning it down. So I think this is a big teaching moment for a lot of people. And so there's promise as well as peril in this place we're at. And I hope to have you come on the show again and talk further as this unfolds. Thanks so much, Jennifer Ruth, for being with us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the people they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. To serve by any means, AIPAC, Kufi, and all the companies. See, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You can ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and up, claiming it's anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist. I seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there and writhing in solidarity and screaming free Palestine with them organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with a state that's gotta rely on apartheid system to uphold and occupy and violent history been repeating for the last 75. The neck but never ended, the colonizer lied. If students in tents posted on the lawn, occupying the quad is really against the law. And a reason to call and the police and their squad were to genocide land in your definition, huh? Destroying every college in Gaza and every mosque, pushing everyone in the rough and dropping bombs. The blood is on your hands, Biden, we can see it all.
That was some of Macklemore's song, Hinds Hall, about the protests against genocide in Palestine and the repression those protests have faced. Student protesters at Columbia University renamed a campus building for Hind Rajab, the 6-year-old Palestinian girl killed in January. She was fleeing with her family when they were killed by Israeli forces, leaving her trapped in the car with their bodies. She spent 3 hours on the phone begging for help from aid workers, but when those workers arrived, they were killed by U.S.-made munitions. Macklemore is donating all proceeds from that single to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Before the song, we heard Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth discussing some of the governmental and economic dimensions of repression faced by educators and students protesting Israeli violence and U.S. complicity. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, where you can find context for the misleading discourse being promoted in mainstream media. I'm your host today, Fran Michel, reminding you that this is KBOO's Spring Membership Drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Please help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000 so we can keep bringing you alternatives to the context-free mainstream media. This is the last week of our spring drive, and a generous donor is matching your contribution dollar for dollar, so give now to support your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station by texting KBOO to 44321 or on the KBOO mobile app, clicking on the red donate box. Online, you can go to bit.ly/KBOO, and offline, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Later on today's episode of The Old Mole, Jan will be back with Mike Snedeker for a Left and the Law segment on using the legal system to punish fossil fuel villains instead of punishing thoughtful academics and students. We turn now to Joe Clement, who shares some history and context for discussions of climate after the 1970s turn away from recognizing the dangers of capitalism and the need for restoring the commons. He's reading from a book by Allison Hope Alcon.
The book's called Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. The particular section from Chapter 2 on Understanding the Green Economy that I want to read describes the co-optation or the shift in environmentalist rhetoric and cachet and practice in the 1970s for one that was critical of capitalism and called for its constraint at the very least, if not sometimes its full-on abolition. To one that takes the capitalist economy and the market for granted as natural. In 1972, a groundbreaking study called The Limits to Growth modeled the effects of increases in population growth and resource consumption on ecological health. It concluded that if current trends continued, they would lead to, quote, overshoot and collapse, end quote, in which human societies could no longer provide for themselves. This influential report lent credence to two approaches to global development. One was the Malthusian argument against population growth, which had become popular among wealthy countries with already low growth rates. Emphasizing population without regard for consumption, however, places the burden of environmental problems entirely on the global south. Many activists seeking to preserve the natural world and increase social equity supported a second approach. Zero economic growth, or steady-state economics. In contrast to macroeconomic policies commonly designed to produce growth, steady-state systems aim for equilibrium, or for slight fluctuations, in both population and production. According to ecological economists like Herman Daly, a steady-state economy does not excessively disrupt natural ecosystems and can protect natural resources. The limits to growth argument was highly controversial. Among its most prominent critics was Columbia University economist Jagdish Bhagwati. In a widely read article in Scientific American from 1993, Bhagwati argued that economic growth would protect the environment, as profits garnered could be taxed and used for the abatement of pollution and for general remediation. To support this position, he pointed to the high numbers of environmental organizations in developed countries with high economic growth, arguing that growth is good for the environmental movement and hence good for the environment itself. Extending his argument in 2009, Bhagwati accounts for social goods as well, arguing that, quote, firms that make losses can't finance corporate social responsibility policies, end quote. Present-day proponents of the green economy similarly argue that economic growth leads to environmental protection. The idea that there were environmental limits to economic growth greatly influenced the U.S. environmental movement in the 1970s, which departed from its preservationist predecessor to advocate state cleanup and control of pollution. Under pressure from the environmental movement, the federal government passed legislation that would constrain profits, reflecting a popular belief that environmental and human health limits to economic growth were sometimes necessary. At the same time, more radical environmentalists developed currents of environmental theory and practice that offered implicit and explicit critiques of industrial culture and sometimes of capitalism itself. Eco-socialists, eco-feminists, and social ecologists argued that domination of nature was a consequence of domination between people and had found its most quote-unquote exacerbating development under capitalism. Advocates of these positions called for collective ownership of the means of production and the restoration of the commons. In addition, deep ecologists who prioritize the intrinsic worth of non-human nature emphasized its protection over economic growth. Their best-known strategy consists of direct action tree sits, in which activists occupy land slated to be logged in order to protect it. Additionally, while a confrontation with capitalism was not always at the top of the agenda for the Back to the Land movement, it attempted to escape the cultural and economic constraints of, quote, mainstream society, end quote, through the creation of rural communes in which resources could be shared. These communes developed some of the early techniques that would enable organic farming and are an important predecessor for many today's food movements and farmers' markets. Participants in this kind of environmentalism advocated the creation of new, non-capitalist ways of being that they envisioned as close to and respectful of non-human nature. Despite their sometimes fiercely argued differences, these voices saw capitalism as something to escape from or confront if the environment and human society were to be sustained. The popularity of environmental discourses arguing for limits on capitalism, quote, came to represent a substantial and growing constraint on capitalist accumulation strategies and thus was ripe for neoliberal attacks. McCarthy and Prudhomme write in 2004 about neoliberal nature and the nature of neoliberalism. These attacks occurred in the wake of the late 1970s energy crisis, which made it difficult to argue against growth and helped propel the Reagan administration's pro-business and anti-environment agenda. In this context, the state abandoned its charge of protecting citizens from the excesses of capital, instead imagining its role as the creator of market conditions favorable to growth. In this reactionary political landscape, sustainability emerged as a discourse that could guide economic and cultural practices, fitting environmentalists' concern into a pro-growth agenda. Environmental activists began to ignore the role of capitalism in environmental degradation, paving the way for a new sustainability paradigm in which economic growth and environmental protection were seen as interdependent. If you just tuned in, I've been reading from Allison Hope Alcon's book, Black, White, and Green, subtitled Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. I thought that I would pair that with one of my favorite songs from the 2012 Lorax movie because of the way that it lays bare the logic of the pro-growth agenda, as Allison Hope Alcon puts it, that is behind the marriage between sustainability and capitalism. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? I'm just following my destiny. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? How bad can I possibly be? Well, there's a principle in nature that almost every creature knows, called survival of the fittest. And check it, this is how it goes. The animal that wins gotta scratch and fight and claw and bite and punch. And the animal that doesn't, well, the animal that doesn't winds up someone else's. La 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 la. It sound. It says the people with the money, make this ever-loving world go round. So I'm bigger in my company, I'm bigger in my factory, I'm bigger in my corporate sign. Everybody out there, take care of yours and me. I'll take care of mine, 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 mine. Shake that bottom line. Let me say smart, you're so.
That was the song, How Bad Can I Be? Performed by Ed Helms and Kool Kojak on the soundtrack album Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, original songs from the motion picture. Before that, we heard Joe Clement reading from Allison Hope Alcon's book Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, for some background on the history of the misleading notion of sustainable capitalism. As Joe mentions, in the 1980s, the state increasingly abandoned any responsibility of protecting citizens from the excesses of capital. And in our last segment today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will be discussing efforts to use the courts to demand the state recognize that responsibility or to make the fossil fuel companies pay for their knowing assault on the climate. The massive amount of money that flows from oil companies and other lobbyists into the coffers of politicians and mainstream media outlets means that alternative media like KABU fight an upstream battle to keep you informed. 80% of KABU's funding comes from members, but only 10% of listeners are members. So please, help us keep fighting against the villains, who can be very, very bad indeed. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and this is the last week of KABU's Spring Membership Drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Many thanks to those who've helped move us toward our fundraising goal of $60,000 and to the donor who's provided matching funds that will double the impact of your contribution. So if you haven't given yet, now is the time to support us by texting KBOO to 44321 or on the KABU mobile app, clicking on the red donate box. Online, you can go to bit.ly/KBOO, and offline, you can mail a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Here is The Left and the Law.
Well, Mike, we have regularly reported on cases around the world, including dozens of jurisdictions in the U.S., that take big oil to court over its big role in the climate crisis. Before turning to updates on cases today on The Left and the Law, let's talk about Trump and his own big oil campaign. Trump invited more than 20 oil and gas company executives to his club last week, asking them for $1 billion presidential campaign contributions and offering in exchange the promise to undo Joe Biden's restrictions on natural gas export permits, oil drilling, and car pollution. So Trump has cut out the middlemen, the lobbyists in this deal. So Mike, is this just an example of Trump making corruption more blatant than the lobbying system of corruption that has been in place for so long?
I think so. I mean, we have a formal way of bribing people, which we call lobbying. And there are ways by which oil companies have shaped policy in this country for decades. And Trump is doing that thing he does that is so refreshing, which is bring all of the kind of slick, oily, textured forms with which corruption takes in the United States and putting it all right out on the table.
Yeah, but
give me a billion and I'll give you billions back.
Yeah, right. It's like a TV ad. Cut out the middleman. Save today. But is there a risk of being too cavalier in this as well? Because even though the system is slick and oily, as you say, morally, politically, it's also, there's a risk in Trump's current campaign in his audacious statements around being the dictator just shortly after he's elected, all of his promises around sweeping immigrants out of the country that they're not taken seriously. And it's not a simple issue translating dog whistles or more traditional forms of corruption into this blatant kind.
Well, that's true. And Trump is kind of clownish himself, but he has behind him a host of very effective administrative conservatives who, for example, the way they organize the appointment of judges in federal courts all over the country has been extremely effective. So his defiance, his temperament, which is always a very attractive feature in anybody, more so than their policies, is one thing, but he's quite capable of allowing to flourish just beneath him a whole host of administrative changes that would make everything worse in this country.
Apparently, Wall Street executives are warming to Trump on some of these very grounds, although they wouldn't state it so crudely, but apparently he's doing better with Wall Street executives for many of the same reasons that see Trump as more friendly to big business.
Well, and that's why litigation can become important. It will become very important if Trump wins again. There'll be nowhere else to hide. And there are a lot of cases moving in important directions.
Yeah, and State Line magazine reported last month that after a long slog, as they put it, climate change lawsuits will finally put big oil on trial. 32 lawsuits now target fossil fuel companies over climate change. Is it the number of cases, Mike, or is it the type of arguments and evidence that makes this significant?
Well, there are at least two types of litigation. One type is embodied by the Giuliana case, which was an effort by a nonprofit organization, Children's Trust here in Oregon, to stop climate change. It got a really good order from Judge Ann Aiken, and they were ready to proceed to trial. The defendants were various companies like Exxon, who have been polluting and who knew for decades that their products would indeed pollute to an extraordinary extent, but while at the same time saying it was all very uncertain as to whether such things would happen. But Giuliana got shot down in 2020.
I should also say it's popularly known as Youth versus Gov, but Giuliana is the lead plaintiff.
Yes. The case lost in the Ninth Circuit 4 years ago in a decision that was really, it was a very close case. And everybody conceded that we were hell-bound train riding toward disaster. And the only issue was whether or not the courts had any role to play. And there was a really vigorous dissent by Judge Josephine Staten saying, yes, indeed, the Constitution does not require us to put our fingers in our ears and let the train hit us without making any effort to fight back.
And where was that judge ruling from?
That was the Ninth Circuit, but it allowed the plaintiffs to amend their case. So they did, and Judge Aiken made a really good and lengthy opinion, essentially saying, let's go to trial. If you can prove what you say, we do indeed have remedies. The government once again appealed, and the Biden administration intervened, and on May 1st of this year, the case was thrown out by the Ninth Circuit, and plaintiffs were not given any chance to amend. So that case is over.
Now, can you explain the writ of mandamus that was central to the ruling? Just briefly.
No, you don't want to know. Writs of mandamus, or you want to mandate somebody to do something because they've have some sort of ministerial duty where they've just got to do it and they haven't done it. The important thing is that that case is over, but it's like a really valiant soldier in a war. All these cases have different qualities and features. And although it's dead, it has paved the way for many other lawsuits just like it and for other kinds of lawsuits. You know, a very different kind of lawsuit, but even more effective kind of lawsuit generally, are lawsuits brought not by nonprofit corporations with idealistic motives, but by people who want to get rich. And that's basically at the heart of a lawsuit brought here in Multnomah County, Oregon, which experienced, as you may vividly recall, the most extreme heat event in Oregon's history 3 years ago, when we had a heat sink 3 or 4 days with highs of 112 and even 116 degrees Fahrenheit here in Portland. There were serious consequences. You know, 40% of Multnomah County does not have any cooling, and people just suffered extremely. 69 people died of heat stroke.
And all the inequities that run through the system and access to services, including air conditioning and tree-lined streets that provide some cooling. I mean, all of those inequities are amplified.
They are indeed. Now, this was not a natural weather event. In the aftermath of this catastrophe, many scientific studies were conducted, all of which reached the same conclusion, that the heat dome was caused by fossil fuel pollution that superheated our planet's surface. It dried out the soil around us, intensified a high-pressure system. It turned Multnomah County into a convection oven. It was a horrible thing that killed trees and people and was not a, quote, natural event. And now there's a lawsuit, a really well-crafted lawsuit brought by a downtown law firm.
That Multnomah County, just to clarify, has enlisted this firm.
Yeah, Multnomah County is the plaintiff. And they've got filed a lawsuit against several leading fossil fuel producers, sellers, industry insiders. They basically allege that the catastrophe was not at all caused by an act of God, but rather by the world's largest energy companies playing God with the lives of innocent people by selling as much oil, gas, and coal as they possibly could, at the same time lying about and concealing how much harm pollution from those products would likely happen, facts that they've known for many decades. And that frame of mind, that ability to prove a fact that you acted in a harmful way, knowing as you did it that it was harmful, is the strength of this lawsuit and the other litigation that's pending now.
So, Mike, I wanted to have you say more about your point earlier that law firms that are in the business of making money and calculating cases they take on that basis, in some ways, are better positioned to go after these big companies, even though we've also talked about this is a long game and that the fossil fuel companies have, as you've said, more money and more power than God, and they can usually outlast their opponents. So what are the dividends in this high-risk situation for companies that expect that they can make money going after these big oil companies over time?
Well, I think all these different forms of lawsuits are necessary, as well, of course, as all the forms of political pressure outside the courtroom that create the ambiance in which court decisions are reached. That has to happen as well. But like the tobacco companies are a good precedent in that for years they successfully evaded and avoided all the efforts to litigate. Then there was discovery made that they themselves knew that their products would cause cancer, and they had suppressed that information. That made lawsuits more valid. There were public interest law firms against them, but there were also bets made by states and by local municipalities and by big law firms that investments might pay off. And eventually—
Investments in these lawsuits.
Investments in the lawsuits.
That itself is kind of an indicator of something.
It is. It's an indicator of possibility. People are willing to take a chance and to invest in something they might lose. They're willing to risk, but there has to be a huge payoff within sight, a credible path toward making billions of dollars. And that's what I think people see now. There is a way, for example, in Multnomah County, the heat sink was a distinct event. It had tangible, measurable outcomes. There's lots of science showing that it was not a natural event. That's supported by the fact that there's never been anything like it before. So how natural can it be? The lawsuit has every chance of, it doesn't have every chance, not a guaranteed success, but the possibility means that there will be significant investments made in discovery. You know, it costs money to depose people. It costs money to review 40,000 pages of documents and extract information. People are willing to make those kind of investments now, not only for the reasons of doing good and saving the planet, but also of getting rich.
So law firms also get rich through various settlements. And, you know, the whole legal system in this country is, we were talking about legalized bribery and corruption earlier, but there is a lot of that in civil lawsuits where, as well as criminal lawsuits, but we're talking about civil lawsuits where powerful companies pay out. You know, big pharma's settled many cases by paying pretty large sums to plaintiffs to settle cases. I mean, could this end up being just another way of a cost of doing business? You periodically pay a billion here, a billion there?
Of course. And they have, 2022 was the best year in history for oil companies. They're making billions of dollars every week. So they've got, you know, vast funds. But
they've done okay under the Biden administration, we should note.
They've done just fine. But like the tobacco companies ended up signing a settlement for over $200 billion. And that was a few years back. So they could be these, you know, a billion here and a billion there. And after a while, you do start talking about important money. And when you get into individuals, that's when you can start making things sting. They're going to be deposing individual executives who made certain decisions. The more discovery they get, the more results they get that are favorable, the more opportunities to go after separate people, which will definitely get their attention, the more possibilities will open up for injunctive relief and other sorts of relief that would target their actual behavior and place limits on them. So all of these things are going to require an attention span at least as long as that of the oil companies, and that attention span is endless.
So a key of these cases, just to clarify the point you were making earlier, is that it's that the knowledge of the effects of their products that were hidden, it's not the effects themselves, it's the knowledge for a sustained period of time and an intentional campaign to conceal, distort, or deny that knowledge. That's what the cases hinge on, is that correct?
That's a critical element. You've got to prove intent, and they now have that critical element. Their delay in some ways has worked against the oil companies, because what surfaced just not long ago is that Exxon had predictive models of exactly what happened, in effect, in the 1970s and 80s.
Around global warming.
Yes, and the fact that by 2030 it would be catastrophic. It followed with eerie accuracy. I mean, I haven't seen any predictions from anyone else, including universities and institutions of any type, that are as spot on as the predictions made by Exxon in 1983 of the effects of global warming in 2020.
Is their general defense strategy in these cases, which I assume differs in jurisdictions, but is it that they didn't know, they didn't get the memo that day, or is it that, well, they were in a bind because they're still producing a product people need and they're doing their best to ameliorate these effects? What's their best defense strategy?
Delay. The first move made in the Multnomah County case, as with every other case around the country, is an effort to move it from state court to federal court. And in federal court, they have an easier task, the oil companies do, because they can challenge standing. They have all sorts of other ways of impeding progress on the suit. So they don't ever want to get to the merits of the issue. Good God, you're talking about what they knew and when they knew it. They want to mess around with jurisdictional struggles and standing issues for a long, long time.
Every night, as far back as I can remember, we hear CNN commentators explain that Trump's strategy is to delay, delay, delay. It's not only Trump's strategy. It'd be nice if they also talked about other cases other than Trump, but it's a familiar playbook by
yes.
A lot of people in power.
Well, last year was a very important year for this kind of litigation, because that's when the U.S. Supreme Court essentially turned back or did not act in the oil companies' interest by allowing them to remove cases from state to federal court. They refused to allow a case that we talked about when we first started talking about these cases, the one brought by Keith Ellison in Minnesota. The first strategy there was to remove it to federal court, and federal court, the circuit court there, said, this is not our case, and the oil companies appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court did nothing. So now that one is back in state court and it can go ahead. And the whole effort to stall by moving cases from state to federal court is taking a severe hit from them refusing in two other cases to grant certiorari and take this up as if it were a seriously important issue, the right of the oil companies to remove from state to federal court.
Okay, and closing today, Mike, our regular report on bringing big oil to court, I want to remind listeners that on KBOO, including the Old Mole Variety Hour, it's one of the few places where you do hear these regular updates on taking the fossil fuel industry to court, because the mainstream press rarely, if ever, mentions these cases and they're important. So we'll return to these cases with updates regularly.
Good. Let's do that.
Thanks, Mike.
That was Winston Flagg Smith performing The World is on Fire, and before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing legal efforts to get the arsonists to pay. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host today. Thanks to today's contributors to the Old Mole. Thanks to Jan Hocken and her guest Jennifer Ruth and her Left and the Law partner Mike Snedeker. Thanks to Joe Clement for sharing scholarly reflections on the tensions between growth and survival, and for playing our theme song. And thanks to Patricia Kullberg for behind-the-scenes editing help and keeping the moles organized. Thanks to all the staff, volunteers, and listener members of KBOO. Thanks to those of you who have contributed to KBOO's spring membership drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Thanks to the donor who's given us a $20,000 match, so every donation you make this week will be doubled, dollar for dollar. This is the last week of our drive to raise $60,000 by May 25th. So you can help by going to bit.ly/KBOO or texting KBOO to 44321 or clicking the red donate box in the mobile app or mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The Old Mole will be back next Monday. Stay tuned now for Locus Focus. We'll go out with a little more of Hinds Hall. What you willing to risk? What you willing to give? What if you were in Gaza? What if those were your kids? If the West was pretending that you didn't exist, you want the world to stand up, and the students finally did. Let's get it.
With the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO, independent radio since 1968. Support our station and fight the status quo by donating to our spring membership drive, now through May 25th. During our last week,